Hello, you're listening to Spoiler.
Filled.
Film.
Conversation.
Hooray!
Hooray! Woo!
Yay!
I'm Richard Nicholas, hello, and with me to chat about films are Abigail Bain,
Hi there.
Jamie Thomas,
Hello.
and Anthony Evans.
How's it going?
Going fine, thank you for asking. So, guys, this week's film is the film Paprika. Before there was Inception, there was Paprika. And it's Anthony's pick, so I'll let him give the details of this Japanese mind bender.
Okay, well, Paprika. When a revolutionary machine that allowed therapists to enter and interact with their patients' dreams is stolen, the lines between reality and dreams starts to break down. Only a young female therapist can stop it with the help of her dream world alter ego, Paprika. It was directed by Japanese animator Satoshi Kon in 2006, with a screenplay by Kon and Seiichi Minakami, based on an excellent novel by Yasutaka Tsutsui. I believe we all watched the English dub of the movie because, well, it's very well done, and it includes the voice talents of Cindy Robinson, Paul St. Peter, Yuri Lowenthal, David Lodge, Brian Peacock, and Doug Erhaltz.
Yeah, we just dodged all those awkward Japanese names. But I'm sure that the Japanese people did a good job as well, so clap, clap.
Yes.
So, Anthony, why did you put this film to us? And I mean, maybe explain the context for your expectations being high, seeing as you're quite a big fan of this whole little niche of the world, aren't you?
Yes, I suppose. I should start off by saying then that this is probably one of my favorite films of all time, and probably my favorite animation of all time. I can't remember why I seeked it out ages ago. Probably from it's got an interesting trailer, so I probably got it from there. But yeah, like the first time I saw this film, it just kind of blew my mind. In kind of all aspects, like just storytelling and filmmaking and just how ambiguous like film can be and whether that's like an advantage or a disadvantage. But anyway, I suppose I can't really go into my expectations because I just this is probably just one of my favorite films. And I just thought I'd bring it to the table because there is certainly a lot to talk about.
There is. Abby, what did you expect before watching this? Maybe the first time, because I think this is your at least second time watching it.
Well, I assume that this movie had the same form that anime has in general, the sort of way that they approach things visually and the madness that comes along with it, really.
Yeah.
But I didn't know that much about it specifically. I pretty much only had Anthony's recommendation for it.
Yeah.
But I came in with an open mind, as it were, and I was ready to enjoy it.
Good. I think generally speaking, when I first came to watching it, I'd only had a slight idea of this kind of wheelhouse of animation where it's the thing with these type of stories. It's usually quite surreal or quite fantasiful things, and usually about a female lead going through a kind of Wonderland type story. So I expected a bit of weirdness, and it was certainly a very colourful, like DVD case. You get the feeling it's going to be all bright colours and madness, and it is that and more. But I wasn't didn't have too many expectations other than it'd probably be all right based on some of the other anime of this type I'd seen. They were all quite reasonable. I think Spirited Away was the main favourite I'd seen before this, and that's quite a good starter film for anyone getting into sort of anime, I think. But no, I didn't have, yeah. I didn't have too much on my mind. Jamie, what about you?
I actually went into this pretty much completely blind.
Oh,
I'd
then
heard
you
of
would have had a terrible film experience.
it. I had heard of it, like, really vaguely. Like, I'd seen the title come up. It's been a long time since I've, like, when I was about 13 or 14, I had like an anime phase.
Where you were animated by Japanese people.
Yes. I'd get embarrassed and a big sweat drop would come off my side of my head.
And he'd fall to the ground whenever he was embarrassed.
Yeah. but I had like, this was back in the days of VHS. I had a little like VHS anime collection. But I forgot about it. Apart from like a select few that I still watch occasionally, like the typical ones like Akira or Ghost in the Shell or like some Miyazaki stuff which I'd seen. But it's been a long time since I've like paid attention to anime. Certainly when Paprika came out, it was just off my radar. So I've seen like allusions to it online and stuff and like screenshots and references, but I had no idea like what it actually was.
Yeah.
So I didn't really know what to expect because I didn't know what to expect from like modern anime. Cause to me, it's all stuff from like the 80s and the early 90s.
Yeah. I'm with you. Like, I guess the visual quality has come on quite a lot. Cause yeah. I mean, initially anime was sort of a basic animation that cut a lot of corners, and that developed the style really of the sort of anime manga-y look, and it kind of created a genre in and of itself, and now it's got the budget and the following to really spend some time creating really amazing visuals. So it's an odd new thing about modern ones. They are just splendid looking,
especially this one, Paprika. I mean, there's such a keen attention to detail in pretty much every shot. I mean, It's just full of all these, like there's a scene where there's a shot of someone's office, and it's just full of all these tiny little things that you just want to see more of.
There's that actually reminds me of something I noticed. It's a good example of that, because it had no bearing on anything that happened in the scene. It was just a really nice little detail. I can't remember the giant fat guy's name again.
That's Dr. Tokita.
That's it. There's a scene in his little office, which is just a mess, when he's fiddling about building something. And there's a shot of him looking at the camera while somebody's talking to him. And behind him, there's like a tissue sticking out of a box and a fan behind it. And the fan's spinning and the tissue's blowing in the breeze.
Yeah.
And I just thought that was a really nice, like for an animation, to put that kind of little detail in the background for no reason other than it, you know, it's just a background detail.
Yeah, and a lot of the time it's kind of a visual feast, both for the eyes and the ears. And I mean, it's quite a, you know, in-depth concept to follow as well. So there's a lot to look at and follow. And it's definitely something that can have repeat viewings where you'll get more out of it, I think. I mean, it's just a buffet of visuals, isn't it, really? You are going to end up like the big fat guy in it. Although, talking about him, his neck repulses me. The fact that he's so big and fat is all right. Like, fat guys are cool. But the fact that they've gone to the trouble of having a really disgusting, obese neck as well. No. Anyone else? Any take on him?
He's pretty large.
He's well done as a sympathetic character.
Yeah, like, the sort of childlike genius, but then also this kind of lummoxing, clumsy man.
Yeah, and he is the one who has created the machine in question, the DC Mini, which allows you to see and somewhat manipulate other people's dreams.
I thought it was... I've never seen a character in anime that looks like him and isn't a full cranked up caricature.
Yeah, he's an actual... He's a person.
Yeah.
As well as being huge.
He's not just a clumsy fat oaf. He's a kind of very interesting character type, yeah.
And he actually has not to jump too far ahead, but everything works out for him in the end.
Yeah.
In a way that a character like that, it wouldn't normally, like, he gets the girl. He marries the female doctor. Again, I can't remember her name. The one whose alternate is Paprika.
Her name is Chiba.
Yeah, he he's in love with her and it's kind of unrequited. But then at the end of the film, they like it's revealed that they end up getting married.
Yeah. What I found weird about it, actually, upon second viewing, is I thought that their sort of love story wasn't really what it was about, and yet it seems to be the important element to defeating the bad guys. It seems tangentially to be that if she admits to her love for him, hooray, the reality doesn't get blended with the dream world. I didn't quite understand why, you know?
They had to use a little shorthand in this for it to roll along nicely and for it to work visually. But it was occasionally confusing as to whether or not she actually needed to be plugged in to be able to do things.
Because the thing is, this we should talk really about the concept that this is based on. It's the idea that you can use a piece of equipment to go into people's dreams. And, you know, it's a bit like Inception, even though it came first, in that you can sort of manipulate them and also see other people's, you know, thoughts. And they're trying it out. It's sort of experimental and, you know, it's the first sort of trials with people they're doing. And it sort of starts getting more confusing. I don't know, it's kind of hard to explain.
There's like two kind of main plots. Like, the main plot is, like, their machine is stolen. And they have to go and retrieve it through any means, whatever they do. And then there's the kind of a main subplot centered around the detective Konakawa about how they are using the machine to interpret his dream and kind of like psychoanalyze him and try and make him better.
It's a nice like way of demonstrating how the machine works at the same time as having the main plot of it being stolen, like ticking along at the same time. So you, like, you get this like active demonstration.
What I didn't get with the Konakawa part is he seemed to be able to get into Side of Dreams just by using his laptop.
Yeah, I think there were times it was a bit ambiguous. Like you mentioned, Chiba also can get into people's dreams without the machine sometimes, but then other times she needs it. I didn't quite understand if I'd got it right.
I think it's a bit of a shorthand. I mean, there are scenes where, like, Konakawa's at his laptop and it appears they're going to, like, some sort of bar.
Mm.
And I think that's just... I think it's more of a visual representation of their meeting at, like, an internet cafe, perhaps.
It doesn't.
But then the whole film is kind of like about the blurred kind of reality of dreams.
Yeah, I was gonna say that it doesn't. It depends on who's watching it as to whether this is positive or negative. But it doesn't particularly patronize the viewer in that it doesn't necessarily explain things. It just goes along, and I think like. You could see that as a weakness because it could potentially be frustrating to sit there and think and just be thinking what's happening now, but if you're the right kind of audience, the film is so like visually interesting that if you don't pick up on the plot properly the first time, you want to go back and watch it again to figure it out because the first time you were just along for the ride because it was so colourful.
Yeah. Well, you certainly have to concentrate. If you do just sort of passively watch things, you are not going to be able to keep up. And part of the enjoyment out of it, really, is trying to second guess what's real. Because once you establish, straight away, basically, we open with a dream sequence that we don't know is the dream sequence initially, but it starts going weird, and there's multiple versions of the detective. What's his name?
Konakawa.
Konakawa, right? And we're in his dream and establishing that there's this machine that can help other people go into your dreams and sort of, I don't know, help you with psychological issues and things. That's maybe what they're thinking of using it for. And it's a really good opener because it's just mad and surreal. And it sets the tone of this what kind of world bending into each other animation thing. The whole thing is all the way through. We think we're maybe in reality a minute and then hang on. This wall is melting and I'm like now fighting off giant objects and kitsch. I mean, it is full generally of kitsch and knickknacks and weird pieces of Japanese culture all the way through.
What I really liked about the parade actually was that those Japanese sort of archways were part of the parade, just walking along in their two giant legs.
Yeah, they've got like lampposts, because, you know, it's like things you'd expect to move, like dolls and frogs and stuff. And it's just got like all kinds of objects and weird stuff in the parade. Did anyone else have any like funny spots from the parade that's featured throughout as a kind of symbol of everyone's dreams becoming one?
I remember some walking microwaves.
Yep, like a fridge as well, or something.
And a dancing fridge, yeah.
The brave little toaster fan in me loved that.
I remember some people, like later on, towards the end, some people turning into those weird fat cats that kind of wave at you.
Yeah, my favourite of the people like transforming into things as they're sucked into the parade is the girls whose heads become like flip mobile phones. And then they lift their skirts up, and some guys whose heads are also flip mobile phones, like, dive down underneath and take pictures of their skirts.
They're honest about their culture.
That's. I think that's something we should say, is the Japanese culture and their way of filmmaking is very different, and I suppose some people would find kind of really weird.
It's kind of,
especially from a Western point of view.
Their media is very surreal and very kind of neon and very loud and brash.
Yeah, and I think this kind of film can only have come from that society.
I can't imagine this being remade for a Western audience. I mean, you could argue that Inception is almost there, but
someone like Buñuel did things a bit like this, but he was always just a little bit more grim.
this film is surprisingly dark in places, and when it does get like disturbing or dark, you think, oh wow, hang on. And it is very much like it's the kind of nightmarish when those scenes kind of kick in.
Mm.
But it hasn't got that. It isn't. It's still colourful and neon. It's never bleak.
Yeah, I think the Western equivalents of stuff like Alice in Wonderland and The Wizard of Oz and things, and even they have a different tone. I mean, Alice in Wonderland's very British, and there's a sense of weird dreamlikeness and dread at times. There's dark with the light. And, you know, but it's just so full of Japanese culture. I guess it's, you know, people's dreams in Japan are going to be full of the pop culture that's around them. And so it makes sense that when people's dreams are visualized for us, they are full of these inexplicable, weird parts of their culture. So
there's a nice example of that where Paprika appears dressed as Monkey from Journey into the West.
Yeah, yeah. There's all kinds of just these little things that are just kind of weird and funny and like well-observed bits of how the dream world works. I think it understands dreams, and it's definitely trying to make a big point about how dreams are kind of amazing and kind of baffling, and then have a little play around with what if, you know, we could get into our dreams and then reality and dream could be mixed together a bit more. But there's lots of films that deal with kind of dream worlds and reality getting mixed. And I feel like sci-fi dream films can always go a fine line between hard to follow and kind of compelling. Because at times I think this film kind of, you know, falls into traps of not being, like, I don't know. I think the story part of it doesn't make as much sense as, say, the visual side of it is quite the journey to go on. But at times I feel like the filmic storytelling doesn't do enough of the groundwork. Does that make sense?
Are you kind of saying, like, it's not a very nice way to put it, but kind of style over substance?
To some extent, I feel just like it's such a visual feast, and it's such a, it's all about reality and stuff. And dreams, and never knowing when you're in a dream, and some of it doesn't really make enough sense in a tangible way. Like, there's not enough clearly explained motivation for things, and there's not enough reason why things could, like, why can people go into dreams when they want to, and other times they need a machine? And why is it that the people who want to control this technology are doing what they're doing, and like it gets explained a bit, but filmically, I feel like it you know doesn't have enough structure.
I understand what you're saying. I think I've seen this film a lot of times, so I can come at it from a lot of different angles, shall we say? Mm. And I think you've hit it on the head. I think the two kind of big flaws with it is what you just said.
it's like, a visual spectacle.
It's more of a visual film. Like the plot and the story is kind of secondary to just all the imagery that it's trying to give you.
That's common to films about dreams, though.
That's what I was
going
to
say.
Yeah.
Like it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And could you argue that the story functions on like almost dream logic itself?
It does. It has to be this way because that's just the way dreams are. If you know what I mean.
It almost seems like it doesn't matter whether it's a dream or reality some of the time, because overall it may as well have just been a dream because it doesn't try and make enough sense of like everybody's story. I really like it as a film, but I wanted to bring up one of the things upon second watching I hadn't realised, because the first time you're just blown away, and the second time I was like thinking about the whys and where it was all going and what it was trying to say, and I felt like, oh, some of this didn't make sense, like there wasn't enough consistency, and that is kind of dreamlike. But then I think, dreams, they're not that interesting.
we do both have the same problem. Actually, wait. This film has done really well for us to like it because we don't like films about dreams.
Because dreams are always so like disjointed; they're not like any regular narrative, and like dreams always change, and like you never know who you are. And they whenever you like people's dreams never make sense when you say them back, and they're only really interesting to you if you've experienced them. So people start talking about their dreams, you're like, doesn't matter how many times you fought off the Baked Bean Army and then teamed up with Sean Bean, and you know elbow dropped a cat, and it doesn't matter. I wasn't experiencing it, so it's hard to get interested in dreams. But this film does just create such amazing visuals, it gets you on board with essentially a dream, you know, story.
A lot of the time, when a film has a dream sequence, it doesn't actually function the way a dream does.
Yeah.
The only other filmmaker I can think of who kind of captures what a dream actually often feels like is David Lynch. And this film, to me, is almost like a colourful version of his film logic.
Sure.
Like, it's a less, you know, disturbing version of...
Like if he got some therapy and felt a bit better about himself.
Yeah.
It is a difficult thing to get right. I think one of the things that is very hard to get about dreams correct is usually you can't focus on all that much. If anything, a screen showing you everything means you can look around it and see loads, and this film, you know, exploits that. But sometimes I think you can only really concentrate on so much in a dream, and so as soon as you take your attention off something, it kind of fades and maybe gets replaced next time you try and look with it. And I just find that nothing can really get that kind of your own perspective and thoughts, because it's such an intangible world, the dream world. Almost to visualize it is to give it more detail than it has when you're having it often.
There's this recurring thing in dreams I have where people will suddenly change into different people.
Yes.
They'll be playing the same sort of character in my head, but they'll look completely different. It irritates me every time it happens.
And in a way, this film does do that. Characters who are functioning in the dream world, often, you know, their bodies morph or their appearances change. They have, like you know, there's a few of them that's just pop cultural references, but people's, what they're wearing and how they're moving changes. And I think that is a lot more like dreams. You know, it's as close as you can get without putting an audience to sleep and making them have a dream, you know?
Mm.
So it's very successful in getting the dream thing visualised. I think we'd all agree. It does feel like it's about dreams and it does it well.
Yeah. I see.
Yes.
You know, Chiquita changes into a robot.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know if that's a specific reference or a general reference? Does it look familiar to you?
I'm not sure. It's not one that I recognise.
I think they have a lot of wind-up sort of toy robots that are a lot like that.
Yeah. I don't think it's a specific reference like dressing up as Monkey was. But, no.
Okay.
I think genuinely there are toys that, like, the whole spinning head thing and the moving arms is like a toy, generic robot toy that you might get, you know?
You've read the book, Anthony.
I have.
Okay. Is there more in the book that was left out of the film?
Yes. I mean, the film couldn't possibly encroach the kind of... I suppose it's a much more philosophical book, and there's no way you could possibly cram all of that into, 90 minutes of film.
Yeah, because
reading the book does help enlighten you to a lot of things in the film. But they are still quite separate entities.
Yeah.
I think this film is more about kind of creating things and owning things. Whereas the book is much more kind of like psychological, psychoanalysis kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of compelling imagery that would be great for a Freudian psychologist. And you could just kind of make of what you will the men who put themselves in the bodies of dolls and the people who perceive themselves as robots or what have you. And why maybe Chiba personifies herself as Paprika, which is a kind of, you know, an interesting psychological thing going on. So there's a lot, you know, you can see there's a lot to be interpreted out of the story that would make
speaking,
sense.
Speaking about that, the kind of duality, I suppose, between like Paprika and Chiba, it's like this is the only character in the film who has a kind of different alter ego in the kind of dream world.
Yeah.
And I've never quite been able to put my finger on quite why. Because, like, in films like this, where you have kind of, like, two aspects of the same person, they're supposed to, like, you know, find some sort of mutual understanding and come together as one by the end of the film.
Mm.
But that doesn't happen. They do remain quite separated entities that... And even Chiba doesn't even like Paprika that much.
Yeah, it's almost like she's got some kind of split personality and demons that she can't seem to... She wants to be this kind of, like, kooky, happy, brightly dressed character who's kind of fun. And she's a bit more sort of stern and sensible. And it is, like, towards the end, she's a third person... Like, Paprika is a separate person to her, even though they're one and the same. And it's kind of about that in many ways. So it's a very odd conclusion. Like you say, they usually come together and the main character understands who they are now and is a whole. But in this case, it's like, no, I'm kind of letting Paprika go and be free for everyone to enjoy somehow. It's a bit weird in that regard.
Yeah, so I've never quite put my finger on the reasons of that. Other than, I suppose, a kind of, I don't know, the filmmaker kind of hasn't come to a resolution about her.
Maybe.
So just kind of leaves things as they are. Like, you know, like you have Chiba, who's the kind of rational, kind of stern side, and then Paprika, who's the fun, colourful, bright side. But and they still stay separate by the end.
Yeah, it is an odd choice to do that. But then, like you say, Paprika is a personification of Chiba, and she's almost like an alter ego. Whereas other people do, because they're in a dream world and they're aware of it, the people who are trying to control the reality a bit do physically change. And often, when people are taken in and controlled in the dream world by other people, they become personifications of themselves, like the big fat guy becomes a robot. And I think one of the victims of the dream world, like Himuro, he turns into a weird doll woman a lot of the time.
Yeah, and then I suppose we should like state that the parade that happens in the dream is a kind of like a delusion of grandeur, I suppose, that's been taken from like a mentally disturbed person and is being systematically inserted into other people's consciousness.
Yeah,
so they themselves have this delusion then that they are all powerful and.
I was just going to say that everyone is getting sucked into the dream and becoming a slave to it, and that's where it's a problem.
And it's one of the most entertaining aspects of the film when somebody does get taken over by the dream and they just start spouting nonsense. and like charge off out of a window, or you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Especially the first time it happens.
Yeah.
Because like, even though the film kind of starts with like this dream sequence and like an opening, like a quite a fast-paced, colourful opening credit sequence, it does slow down for 5 minutes, and there's a lot of scientific speaking and philosophizing. And then all of a sudden, you just notice that someone's not quite right.
Yeah.
And then it just kind of escalates, and you're like, what's going on?
Yeah, it's like it comes completely out of nowhere. And I like the fact that the other characters' reactions are the same as the audience. They just look at him.
Yeah, like there's like at different times, various doctors who all work in this lab do just start either spouting nonsense or are entangled with stuff and are on a kind of rampage of destruction and can't help it and end up either nearly taking their lives or jumping out of windows, as you say. And there's almost this underpinning threat. At any point, the dream world could bleed into reality and you don't realise it's a dream and you accidentally kill yourself, or, you know, it's a kind of horrible psychotic thing that can happen to anyone. And it's almost like this weird like dream reality infects people and tries to kill them in a way. That's kind of what happens a bit. It's a very hard to get to the nuts and bolts of it. I think we have said some of it there. And it's essentially down to the fact that they found a technology that could go into people's dreams, but due to, you know, mentally ill people, or is it the chairman is the main bad guy, right? Who owns the company that they all work for.
Yes, that's right.
And he... Go on.
I was just going to say, his motivation is control, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
They're all for, like, helping people psychologically with this. I mean, there's any number of ramifications to this, but Inception went their silly way, and this film decided they're going to be, kind of, try and help people medically, but there's, you know, they're still learning, and the chairman has bizarre, unethical plans. It's sort of vaguely evil, but ill-defined at times.
I suppose it's kind of, he's offended by the idea that...
they're tampering with people's dreams.
Yeah, like the subconscious is something sacred to people.
Yeah.
Like, where people aren't supposed to... Other people aren't supposed to experience it.
Yeah.
And they're, like, meddling, and they shouldn't do that. So I guess his, like Jamie says, his ultimate goal is control of that.
Yeah.
But like you said, like this, I think this is one of the bigger flaws of the film is the villains, and you're not quite sure of like their motivation or why they're doing it. It's not specifically clear.
Yeah.
Osanai in particular, I sort of came out of nowhere for me. The chairman, I got, but Osanai was just, oh, you're in love with her, therefore, you're going to imprison her as a butterfly.
What was their relationship, Osanai and the chairman? Because at one point...
The chairman's disabled and for some reason possibly needs the body of Osanai.
Yeah, because they're sharing a bed at one point.
Yeah, that's a very weird... And then it's a kind of after loads of weird dream stuff. So you're like, is this real or is this a metaphor?
Yeah,
I don't know. I think he's needed in a physical capacity for some reason. And he's also an agent of the chairman. It's just, it's there really as like a, oh, he's a bad guy, like kind of reveal, but...
I think there is a very subtle, like, reading of him where he's like a closeted gay man.
I thought it wasn't so much that he was gay so much as he was willing to sell himself again.
Yes, but then it says that kind of specifically with when he sells himself to get the DC Mini in the first place. But then it is... His relationship with the chairman is then kind of really odd.
Well, you see them, like, physically blended together.
Yeah, because he's an agent being used by the chairman, so it's sort of... You know, it becomes like a kind of visual power struggle where they're kind of sharing a body. And what's weird is the chairman always seems to have a kind of tree roots thing going on. I'm not sure what I'm meant to make of it, but he's sort of got this tree thing going on. And then... They're sort of fighting each other and trying to stop Paprika and things. And it's kind of, it's all a bit, you know, why? But it's kind of, it works in terms of visually, it's just, whoa, what's going on? I think there's also, from his point of view, a jealousy maybe of the big fat guy and how genius he is and how childlike he is. But he's irresponsible because of that and doesn't put in special safeties and things in the machinery. So there's a kind of maybe a rivalry as well motivating him, jealousy. But you're right, Abby. There is a sense of, you know, I think people's motivations are lacking sometimes. And because you're too busy concentrating on, hold up, what's going on now and what does this mean and what's the ramifications of all this? But essentially, there's an evil bad guy team manipulating reality in this dreamscape and exploiting the fact that they can go into people's subconscious and mess with them and trying to control this technology, which is getting more and more out of hand. And it's just basically a long investigation into what's going on and who's doing this from the point of view of Chiba and the point of view of the detective Kunikawa.
Well, that's the thing I like, is that as it's going on, you have this side story with the detective of him trying to discover the secret of one of his own recurring dreams.
Yeah.
Which I thought, like, that was interesting enough that I thought that could have been the film by itself.
The kind of noirish detective story with a difference, because it's about exploring your dreams.
All the movie imagery and him, like, adamant that he hates movies, but then knowing everything about them and it coming out in his dreams. And I like the bit where he explains what different terms in cinema, in filmmaking mean. And, like, you have him making gestures and the markers are coming up, like, where you would cut and where the line of action is and all that kind of stuff. Like, I thought that was really good.
It is a very intriguing side story. It almost is worth just looking at his story as unless of this huge distraction of, like, dream blending and evil villains trying to sculpt reality and things. And it is, like you say, a kind of straightforward... Well, not straightforward, nothing straightforward about this film, but an interesting story into someone's, like, forgotten past and their dark issues and also the case they're working on and about, the dreams of things... Oh, basically about dreams that are there because you've got issues in real life and the darker side of the subconscious being a problem for you. So in a way, that's an interesting film that we avoid having sometimes.
As weird as it sounds, it kind of grounds the rest of the story.
Yeah.
Because it gives it... Like, if it didn't have the detective side story, it would just be mental.
I guess.
Whereas, like, the detective side story is, like, surreal, but it has a clear, like, through line, and it gives a sort of a reason to care about the chaos going on outside, because it shows how important it is that this individual has his own subconscious life going on and can make his own discovery, and that the one-on-one help he gets from Paprika benefits him, which is what the chairman is trying to stop.
Yeah.
What I like as well is that his dreams are a really nice palate cleanser to the really mad one.
Yeah.
So when you just spend a little bit of time in a noir dream or you spend a little bit of time in an action dream, it's something that you can understand more and is still a perfectly representative thing of dreams, because sometimes your dreams are relatively straightforward.
Yeah. I think he's also a very likeable character. He's sort of a sensible policeman, but also, you know, he's kind of remembering he has a childlike affection for films and you know, his life's maybe got too serious and he's got his problems so with his past regrets and things. And I think he's a very likable and a good character for us to follow, because otherwise it's just scientists who are all kind of either geniuses or serious and kind of... They've just broken dreams and dreams are leaking into their world and it's creating a massive festival of randomness that is getting too much for everyone.
Without his story, it would have been too much as a film by itself.
Yeah, so, you know, it's crucial to be there, I think. And there's a lot I like. I think the thing that is worth talking about is just the number of cool visuals you never thought you'd see, like giant dolls kind of going into a TV screen and popping out of a camera at the site of a festival and expanding out and people who've suddenly become butterflies being pinned down, and then weird, like, I don't know how to put it, but just the molesting of someone through their body and just tearing them off. Terrifying, but it's kind of visually, whoa, you know?
Yeah, that was really interesting, because it was like... It was one of those moments where the film, like, shocked me a bit, because I didn't realise how far it was going to go with its imagery.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I can't remember the character's name. the one who's pinned Paprika down.
Asanai.
Yeah, puts his hand, like, under her skin and then runs it up inside her. And then when he gets to her head, he pulls it out and she tears open and inside is Chiba.
Yeah. And it's on top of, like, you know, dancing frogs and dolls celebrating their way through the streets. And then, I mean, it's not overly disturbing. It's just kind of creepy and odd.
And it's, yeah, like, apart from, like, one very small scene, it's pretty much a completely bloodless film.
Mm.
And yet there is certain imagery in it that does make you pause a little bit. Like, again, just after that scene, when the chairman emerges from Osanai.
Yeah. I mean, there's so much imagery in there, it's almost worth plucking out your kind of favourite bit that happened. Does anyone else have, like, a bit where they really remember the visuals striking them the first time? I think for me, before you guys go, I think for me, when Chiba is following this little Japanese doll, and she jumps over a barricade, and suddenly it sort of melts away, and she just gets caught as she's jumping out of a like tower building. So it's just a really weird moment where the kind of visual bends and then becomes reality or whatever.
Yeah, that's what I would have chosen. It's a kind of, it's a moment in the film that catches you off guard. Like, it kind of sets up the, you know, is this a dream? Is this not a dream? And it kind of shows you the prescience of that. Like, yeah, people could die. People could be throwing themselves off of buildings.
Yeah.
And they'll never know about it.
I think, for me, the bit that struck me the most was when it started, when there was that bit of reality that was cracking up and it was sort of flaking away. And she went into the sort of backstage area of dreams.
Oh,
and
she kept going.
She went down this hole up to another thing. And it was actually when she came out and she realised that she'd been going through a hollowed out humeral.
Yeah.
That really struck me, just the way that he looked as well.
Is that the scene as well where she sees the chairman's face in like a tree?
Yeah.
That's part of that whole bit.
Yeah.
And that's what's interesting is when they do go into a weird like visual thing, it really snakes around and there's a sense they could go anywhere. And at any point, it's not just, oh, it's a dream. Any part of the reality could bend and change and manipulate. And it's just, you could be anywhere and anything could happen and any person could emerge. And just, there's so many times where like faces merge to other ones and just people start singing some weird song or whatever. And it just like kind of messes with you and has fun with this visual storytelling.
I'd also go back to like the scene that Jamie brought up just now where you have Paprika like pinned down like a butterfly. Just that whole scene, I think there's a lot of disturbing imagery. And it's just, it kind of really gets to you. Well, to me anyway. Like, it's, I remember, like he tries to choke Paprika or Chiba, I think she is at the time, with, like, growing, like, vines from his hand. And there's also a bit where, like, Konakawa is trying to break through the wall. Yeah. And that's a nice moment.
It's weird as well, because it's like he's bending through into the dream from reality and pushing his face through the walls of what we can see. But also, so what? What's happening here? Are you just psychologically battling? Have you got like your fingers to your temples going, like what? How is this actually going down in reality? Is everyone just lying in beds fighting this fight?
I did wonder that actually at certain points. It's like, where is everybody physically right now?
If we saw the reality of it, they would just all be lying down in bandages, just with headsets on.
In that way, it's a lot like The Matrix, where if you think about it, they are just all laid back in those chairs, looking a bit ill.
Yeah, maybe. It's also like Inception. It's just like, and at what point do you come out of that layer of dream and realise that that was just a dream?
I think there's so many like visually striking scenes to choose from. Like one of my favourites was actually the opening credits.
Yeah,
just because it was mesmerising, and that track. That piece of music that I guess is like the main theme is just a really nice, uplifting piece of music.
And it's so full of different sounds that it's kind of happy and cartoonish and
But
infectious.
I think another. My actual favourite is a really subtle scene when Chiba and the head scientist, the little guy.
Yeah.
Have
Shima.
That's it. They've like come round quite late on in the film. And they're discussing whether or not they're actually in, whether they know they're in reality, or it's just before like the dreams completely bleed through.
Mm.
And the detective has just killed
Osanai.
Osanai, he's gunned him down in the dream world. And then as they're talking, you see a hand come up on the glass. And leave like a bloody streak, and then disappear again. And they don't see it, and they keep talking. And there's no like the the shot doesn't like draw attention to it particularly because it's a wide shot of them both, and like you have to just catch it.
Yeah.
And then as she gets up, I think to leave the room, he's there, and he's been shot, but he's like, he's translucent. You can see through him, and he pitches forward and falls towards her, and then he just vanishes.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a really nice like. It was really that was bleak. Like he'd just been eliminated from existence, and that was him. That was the last of him, just fading away.
And then, go on.
And then it was directly followed by the part where he collapses in. I'll call it the Red Room.
Yeah.
Where he's with the chairman, but then he starts bleeding into the not bleeding into the
swirling
floor. He starts
the floor like swallows him up. Yeah.
And at that point, I was not sure where I was in terms of their world.
Yes, because
that
should be the reveal where he's died, but no, his reality is taking him away, or dreams are.
Is that the start of like that giant hole that opens up in the ground that the chairman then emerges from as a shadow creature?
Because all Japanese films should end with someone being hugely giant and in the city, and there should be a kind of giant battle of like wits and robots and things. Do you know what was weird about that? That was a compelling visual, and especially because it's off the back of quite a relieving moment of, oh, we're out of the dream, and it's just going on in the background slightly, his death. And it's visually good, but it is just like, well, what's the ramifications? A detective shot a guy with mind bullets, and now he's being deleted from reality? What? But yeah, this conclusion then at the end of the film, where basically, because he's a villain, there has to be a bit where all of the dream stuff becomes the chairman, and he becomes a big black kind of outline in the middle of the city. And then, does anyone care to explain the kind of final conclusion?
How?
I can't imagine something more nightmarish for my sensibilities than being sort of eaten / just swallowed up. What, just first via my hand and then up my arm. And then, that's horrible.
Yeah, Paprika basically absorbs him. But she becomes giant too.
Because, you know, Japanese film.
Yes.
Yeah, and she starts off as like a baby or a little girl, and then by the time she's done, she's like a fully grown woman.
Giant, naked woman.
Yeah. I'm sure there's some symbolism there, but that's lost on me.
Paprika also gives kind of a row to her. I think is it Chiba? She gives a row to her and says, come on, you haven't got time to save people. And, you know, it's about Chiba kind of loving the big fat neck guy who's just, oh, so big and fat. And just, it was the neck it is. It's the neck that disturbs me. The size and the jokes about how fat and clumsy I is fine, but anyway, like, it's kind of, she's kind of got a compassionate side, whereas then Paprika's kind of like not as caring. It's kind of odd. Amongst all the other oddness of the conclusion.
Yeah. It is, but I think ultimately Paprika, that's the kind of thing, it's like she has to be an alter ego because she also has to kind of save Chiba as well.
Yeah. She's almost like an actual, you know, extra character who isn't part of Chiba. It's almost like Paprika is kind of some kind of, I don't know, part of the dream world that tries to, like a kind of guardian angel of the dream world or something, more than just an alter ego. She is actually a group hallucination or something. But for whatever reason, you know, she takes down the big, giant, black old man, shadow thing, and, you know, stuff turns to almost reality.
I think we should say that at this point, like, all of the people of, I suppose it's in Japan somewhere, have just come under this giant parade delusion.
They've all joined the surreal conga line.
Yeah, and it's just kind of like bleeding into reality and everything's just going crazy.
Yeah. But luckily, you know, because Chiba loves the big fat guy, magical saving the day happens because love. I don't know why it happened, but it happened. Did anyone explain what was the reason Paprika had the strength to stop the bad guy? I didn't really... It's hard to follow. I don't know.
It was to do... They mentioned that there's always an opposite and that he had become so dark.
That's right.
That now his opposite of light would essentially neutralise the pair of them. Because she does disappear after she's engulfed the chairman.
Yeah.
And I think maybe light was love?
Well, yeah, there's light and dark, and for a pinch of salt, that's the line. Sorry, yeah, so there's good and evil, and to add a bit of spice, you just have paprika. That's the sort of justification they give. It's some kind of vague pun on adding some spice to something. There's not even a reason why she's called Paprika, really, is there? She's just called Paprika, and she can save the day like Paprika always does. Whether you're making a fajita or, you know, ruining your life with addiction, add a bit of Paprika, sort it all out. it's the weird good bad thing, and it doesn't matter. I guess is the thing. It's good versus evil, yin and yang. You know, whatever. It needs a conclusion.
I suppose the only way, like you said, she's like Paprika is the kind of like the overseer, the kind of guardian angel of it, and I suppose she's the only one who could come to the defense.
What I wish had happened is that we'd seen more of those two bartenders.
They're
called Cougar and Janai, but they didn't really get name dropped in the movie, and they just did that one save.
Yeah.
At one point. And I so wish they'd done more.
I should say that those two characters were originally voiced by the director and the composer of the film.
All right.
Do you know which way around?
I do not, sorry.
Is this like a short one with a little Hitler moustache, isn't there? That's slightly taller.
Yeah.
It says here that it was the director and the author of the book.
Oh, my mistake, sorry.
Yeah.
I was thinking of the commentary on the DVD, sorry.
Because they're essentially an online chat space ident, aren't they? They're kind of a fake bar which you can go to on the internet, but they become kind of agents for good and help out stopping the giant unruly robot with the face of, I want to say his name for really this time.
Tokita.
Ah, oh, I'm sorry. But Tokita has become a big, crazy, out-of-control robot, like a toy robot. And he looks more appealing with just his face on a robot screen. But they do kind of make the save by kind of sending him smashing into a building.
Yeah, they blind him with their banner.
It would have been nice to have them in it a bit more. But then, you know, why were they there in the first place? Just to kind of help the detective along with the story, I guess, and create a meeting place for him and Paprika.
Are they in the book much more than they are in the movie?
No, they're not. It's not really a thing. Like, the whole detective kind of storyline's not really a thing in the book.
All right. Well, it certainly, you know, helps out the film narrative, as we've discussed. One character I don't think we talked about that much, and again, like, I have the problem with the disgusting fat neck thing. Is it Shima who is the head doctor, like an old man?
Yes.
Yeah.
They always do the old people like this, with this kind of beautifully ugliness, all the extra wrinkles and the big, really chunky heads and big glasses and stuff. And he's like, there's not that much caricature with most of the characters. And then occasionally, like, the old people and larger people are kind of caricatured, but they're just so, oh, what is with your old man weird head? But I liked him. Good character. And a kind of positive scientist amongst all the crazy ones. What did anyone else make of him?
He did have the best speech, where he is the one who had that sort of handbrake turn during his speech, where yeah. he was science, gobbledygook, gobbledygook, gobbledygook.
It was a good moment.
And throw myself out the window.
And he was often the kind of, I don't know, emperor of the parade and stuff, wasn't he? And kind of in amongst all the dolls and things, yeah.
I wasn't nuts about the way that Paprika got him out of that dream.
Oh, yeah.
Where she just sort of sank into him and said, I might have to get a bit rough.
Well, I suppose, like, one reading of it is, like, Paprika, her job is to go into people's dreams and fix them, essentially. Mm. So that's what she has to do. She has to go in and she has to figure out how to do that. And at, like, I think it's three different points, I suppose you'd say. She does this for someone in the delusion. The first one is for Shima to get him out of the delusion. Mm. The second one is for Takeda to get him out of the delusion. And then finally to break the whole thing. So I think it's just that's her job. She knows what she's doing, but she just has to find out how to do it for each specific person because they are infinitely different.
Are you saying
you see what I mean?
Dr. Shima's just a dirty old man, and that's what he needed?
Well, who knows? Well, but it was, you know, she'd already tried kind of like different approaches. Yeah. Like, tried reasoning with him and stuff, so she's just... Well, the thing that finally works is the kind of more physical, I suppose, thing, which is just what snaps him out.
Yeah.
I guess what you're saying about Paprika's role is kind of to fix people's, you know, subconscious and help them out with their problems, and that's kind of the goal of Chiba, and that's why it makes sense that her alter ego is this kind of, you know, Paprika character who's just kind of not her personality exactly, but a variation on her and a more positive kind of fun version. And I guess it doesn't make quite sense to say that they split and become separate entities, but it makes sense that Chiba is her role as a scientist is to help people, and when she's in people's dreams, that's the role that she takes as Paprika. So it kind of makes sense. I don't know if it makes sense in, like, because it's a film about dreams, maybe it's not meant to make entire sense, yeah. But you kind of go, well, hang on, why? How is Paprika also a separate entity again? And, you know, you can pull apart this thing and say, oh, there's problems. But I think overall, the whole experience is so fun, bold, imaginative. You forgive a lot of the things that you kind of go, hang on, what's that? You know, some of the best films that are really high concept sci-fis, if you actually think about them, they don't make sense. There's a reason they're a sci-fi, and it's because things like this don't happen, and logic is ignored sometimes. I guess that's my summing up of my thoughts in a way.
Yeah.
Does anyone else want to, like, you know, say anything in conclusion or bring up another part we might not have talked about?
It was nice the way that they resolved Konakawa's dream, because it was all about his friend who had died and that he hadn't finished making the movie that they were making together.
But he'd lived the life of the character from the film, so yay.
Sort of. Yes.
He'd become a cop like he was playing in the film. And, you know, that's good. Yeah, right.
Well, I think with him, it was more about he'd locked away his kind of love for filmmaking and, like, creating things. And then that was reopened then.
Yeah, I
the
guess
end.
So. He'd become and too it, serious. And it's,
yeah, and oh, it's nice how the film finishes with him going to see a movie.
Yeah. Also, it's a very sly plug for the other films they might have made. Like, it was all posters up for, like, other animations, and it's like, I recommend this film. Like,
do notice there are three films. He's only ever made four films because, like, unfortunately, he died about 4 years ago, whilst making his, like, fifth film, which remains unfinished.
Oh.
And his other films are up there.
Very sly, though. That's just cheap. I think Paprika literally recommending another film to watch is a bit cheap.
Although I will say they're all very good. Sure. They're all very, very good.
Oh, I guess it's fair enough. But like, yeah, I guess that is the kind of conclusion it's trying to make, is just don't lose your childhood innocence. And it is a kind of a love letter to films as much as an exploration of dreams. Jamie, any final thoughts?
I think it's a very interesting film. I think it could be considered a bit frustrating, maybe, purely because of the way the plot flows. There's so much going on all the time.
Like a dream, you just have to roll with it and not worry about what it means.
But I think if you enjoy, like, anime, not necessarily anime, just animation generally, enough, and you give it a bit of space as far as how surreal it is goes, then you could go back and watch it multiple times and get more out of it each time.
Hmm.
So, if you're the kind of person who likes to rewatch films repeatedly, then I think there's more reward more you watch it.
It's certainly not a film that can be got on the first.
Yeah, and it's not a like casual background noise kind of film either.
Yeah,
because you know if you like you look away for a second and you look back and suddenly you're what?
Hmm.
What happened?
Yeah. That didn't actually happen once. While I was watching it, because I haven't been sleeping very well lately, so I got very, very tired. And I think I only dozed off for just a couple of minutes, because I was so tired. And when I opened my eyes, I didn't know what was going on. If I hadn't have seen it before, I probably would have had to start again.
Yeah, there were even scenes as I was paying attention where I suddenly went, wait, what? Like, I think it's when dreams break through into reality and the Chiba and the little scientists are in the skyscraper that they're in, and suddenly the giant doll is outside the window.
Yeah.
And because neither of them initially really react,
they just sort of stare. Yeah.
Yeah. I kind of thought, wait, what? But I think if you appreciate animation and you have a lot of patience,
it's very rewarding, isn't it?
That's exactly what I was going to say. It can be a rewarding experience, especially if you're willing to like watch it over and over again. And I think there's enough going on in it that you can enjoy it each time as well, because it's so like it's so kind of visually appealing and interesting.
Hmm. I mean, I hope you guys are all thinking of what spice this is or whatever, or whatever we're going to rate it as. And I'll ask Anthony his last thoughts, and then everyone could chip in with a kind of weird rating if they want. So, Anthony.
Well, I don't really know what to say. I mean, you've all kind of brought it up. I mean, I'm glad all of you really enjoyed this film, because it is one of my favorite films. Just because... there's no other way of putting it. There's so much you can get out of it. Repeat viewings. I have watched this film at least 10 times and enjoyed it every time. Never got bored.
It's like going back to a buffet. And, you try different stuff each time.
Yeah, and just find something new each time. There's so much symbolism. There's so much attention to detail. There's so much philosophy. There's so much this film could be and is about.
Yeah, that's funny as well. It's got like a good sense of humour running throughout it.
Yeah, and it's one of my favourite films of all time. I don't know how much more to recommend it than that.
Well, it's pretentious, Anthony. That's one of its flaws. No, you know, it is a really good film.
I'd be the first to admit its flaws. Like, I mean, yes, it's confusing, slight style over substance.
Yeah.
But
no one seems to think of the ramifications of anything. All sci-fi's let me down when they come up with a really weird concept and they don't think of the ramifications. That's partly the point, though, is they make a piece of technology called, what's it called, the DC Mini, which I think sounds like a little children's version of, like, do you know this superhero squad with all tiny version of Marvel characters? DC Mini seems like a chubby... No, not chubby. Like, sounds like a tiny, chibi version of all the DC characters. I could imagine all the little Batmans and Supermans. Anyway.
I will say, just because Anthony said about style over substance, I will always defend. I don't think that's always necessarily a bad thing.
Oh, no, I definitely... No, but totally people, works, yeah.
People often like levy that as a criticism. And I think, especially if, well, films, music, whatever, I don't think that's necessarily universally a bad thing.
Yeah, I get where you're coming from. I think I do like a balance. I like there to be style. I like every box to be ticked. And that's why it doesn't, like, I get why it's one of your favourite films. I think that's why it isn't in my favourite films. But I do enjoy it whenever I come to watching it, because it's so interesting and it is so beautiful and creative. But then because it doesn't have certain other tick boxes, like it doesn't you know, feel perfect to me. But then you can always flip the argument and go, "Ah, Rich, but it's about dreams, so it gets away with it."
Well, yeah, dreams aren't perfect.
So, do we have a dream or a spice or some kind of rating we can give Paprika? Anyone?
I've kind of got one.
Go on.
You know, when it's not a single spice, but you know, you can get, like, when you go to, like, any supermarket, and you get, like, the spice section, which has all the specific ones and different seasonings, yeah, and stuff. But then you get, like, the cheat one, which is, like...
mixed herbs or Chinese five spice.
Yeah, yeah. Steak and chicken or something like that. And you look at it, and it's like it's all these little colourful kernels in a jar,
right?
And you think you can't just mix all this stuff together and have it work, but you're surprised how many dishes you use it on where it does actually work really well.
Sure, I think that metaphor makes sense. It's a surprising herb combo.
Yeah, it's okay. Just a collection of colourful stuff and. You're surprised at how many different angles it works from.
I mainly only use, like, mixed herbs for my cooking, because it's just like, I don't know what herb I actually need. Let's just have a selection of a few. Okay. Abby, do you have anything?
I think that this movie is star anise.
What's that?
Which is a type of herb that looks like a star.
Right.
I say it's a spice that looks like a star, I should say.
Really?
And I think it's this because... when you look at a star anise, you have no idea what it is you're looking at or what it's for. And it's only once you actually become initiated to it that you appreciate it for its use and flavour.
Oh, very good. Nice. Atzi, do you have anything? A spice from the spice rack of films?
We're getting a bit thin on the ground here, but I suppose I'd say it's less of a spice, more of just like a red hot chili. It's like you can look at it and you can either know what it is or not, but once it's in your mouth, I mean, all bets are off, like.
And in a way, it's an acquired taste, you know. You have to know what you're in for with it, with a red hot chili, and this is certainly not for, you know, casual film goers.
Yes.
I'm gonna go on the nose and say that Paprika is a lot like Paprika, because you know, it's in the cupboard. It's something you might use occasionally. It doesn't come out all the time. It's quite good for, like, you know, spicing up the odd thing. Like, so I won't find myself enjoying it most of the time. Every now and again, you get it out of the cupboard, you whap it on a bit of chicken / the DVD player, and you have a nice paprikary meal, and then you're done for a bit. You don't need another weird paprikary dream sequence. And you go, you know, it's kind of, use occasionally spice, but it is kind of, it has its purpose and its place, and a kind of, you know, spicy taste to it. So there.
Okay. I was waiting for someone to go, well, it's paprika.
And I went there because it was too easy. Yeah, so, you know, I think that pretty much covers it.
I think so.
I agree.
Covers it all in Paprika. Because sometimes the world is good and bad, and you just need a little spice. And that spice, I don't know why I'm saying that. Let's say goodbye.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Bye. If you could somehow do the music from Paprika, like...
Oh, something I probably should have, like, brought up is, like, the the music in this film is the first time that they ever used like something called a Vocaloid. The Vocaloid in this film, which...
That sounds like a cartoon superhero. Vocaloid, Vocaloid.
Provides a synthetic voice, a synthetic singing voice.
Oh, yeah.
So it's not an actual real human voice. It's a, like, synthetic one. So that kind of, like, probably adds to the kind of beautiful weirdness of the music.
Indeed.
I love the music in this film.
It is rather awesome. Good.
I think, like, it's really catchy. One of my favourite soundtracks.
It's a good one. Thanks, Anthony.